that's what I need to get going. Right now, that's what I need every time I come on the air is this song, those drums, and you listening, all right? At the back end of the show, we're going to be discussing the latest play from the internationally acclaimed South African playwright Athol Fugard, The Painted Rocks at Revolver Creek, and we're going to be talking with director Simon Levy and actors Thomas Silcott and Suanne Spoke. Before that, people need to know that there is a trial going on in Los Angeles, and it's the trial of people arrested during the April 14th demonstrations against police murder and brutality. The April 14th protesters, 15 of them were arrested last April 14th, and 10 of them are now facing trial for protesting to stop police murder. And the first group of these protesters began their trial on November 5th. All 10 face serious misdemeanor charges for civil disobedience, and we'll be talking with two of those defendants, Lucha Bright from the LA Revolution Club, and Joe Scogan, who describes himself as a person who saw what was wrong and had to do something about it. And opening the show up, I'm very pleased to welcome back to the show Orpheus Reed. Orpheus writes on environmental issues for Revolution, RevCom.us, and he recently published a piece on Obama's decision to reject the Keystone XL pipeline, which would bring super-polluting crude oil from Canadian tar sands to refineries in the U.S., increasing the destruction of the environment in the U.S. and Canada in multiple ways, and adding to the problem of climate change, which is rapidly approaching a global catastrophe. Why did Obama do it, and what does it mean for the planet and the U.S. empire? Here to talk with us about that is, as I said, Orpheus Reed. Orpheus, welcome to the show.
Hey, glad to be here, Michael.
Well, I've been wanting to talk to you for quite some time, my friend. You wrote a recent article that really kind of jumped out at me, and I thought it was really important, especially after our last conversation. We last met speaking about Obama and his plans to drill for oil, or to sell the right to drill for oil in the Arctic and just completely destroy the entire planet in doing so. But now you just authored an article called Obama Rejects Keystone XL Pipeline, Why and What Does It Mean for the Endangered Planet? And I thought it was an extremely, really, an article that really helped me understand quite a bit about what's going on and what's at stake here. So let's just jump into my first question, all right?
Okay, sounds good.
Now, for people who aren't deeply familiar with the Keystone XL Pipeline and tar sands, and like for myself, I've paid attention to this, but actually understanding what's the big problem here. What is it, and why is it that this decision is so significant?
There's a bunch of things going on with the tar sands and the Keystone XL pipeline. So the Keystone XL pipeline would have brought 830,000 more barrels per day of tar sands oil from the Alberta tar sands into the United States to be refined in the Gulf Coast. There's several different aspects here. One of them is that the tar sands oil itself is extremely dirty and more carbon polluting even than normal oil, and that's because of just what it takes to produce the oil and various other factors that are involved. So it's extremely carbon polluting, and also the tar sands itself, the extraction process in the tar sands is just horribly, horribly environmentally destructive in that region in Alberta. I mean, you're talking about huge, huge areas of the land that have been stripped bare, that they just basically mow down these whole areas of forest, and then they seek to dig out by strip mining they also inject huge amounts of steam into the ground. They have to actually heat this oil because it's so thick and so mixed with other things so that they can even draw it out of the ground. So it's just a tremendously destructive process there. It's causing a lot of damage in the area. You're losing trees, forests being wiped out, and also it produces a lot of toxic waste products that leak into the groundwater. And so a lot of the rivers and the lakes in this area have been contaminated, the lands. And in fact, the indigenous people that live in these areas have also suffered increased rates of cancer that has been linked directly to this tar sands production. So all of this stuff is going on, and that doesn't even mention the danger of damage of leaks from oil spills that can happen with increased pipeline.
And already,
so all of these things are kind of tied up in this environmental destruction that mm-hmm. this would have led to.
There already have been some big spills and whatnot in terms of transporting tar sands oil down across Canada and across the U.S., right?
Yeah, that's true. There's already an existing Keystone pipeline that comes into the U.S., and there was a huge spill in 2010 that happened in the Kalamazoo River in Michigan. That was a pipeline of tar sands oil that was owned by Enbridge, and that stuff basically caused this massive spill into the Kalamazoo River. And this stuff is so thick and heavy, when it hits water, it just sinks. So a lot of that oil spill has never even been fully cleaned up. So the damage that can occur from the spills that are going on is really is really a horrible factor, too. And these pipeline spills are actually increasing as the U.S. has stepped up its oil production and so forth. There was a study by the Associated Press, basically, that linked, as U.S. oil production has boomed, pipeline accidents have also increased pretty much in step with that. They've increased something like 60% since 2009.
Now, tell me this, because we just spoke about, a little while earlier, back in September, we spoke about the whole way that the moves to drill for oil in the Arctic, what Obama was pushing there, and we talked about the push there being rooted in U.S. imperial interests overall and their quest to continue the domination of the world. Now we come up and you have this whole thing that you've just laid out about the tar sands oils and the Keystone Pipeline and all the dangers involved and all that. So now Obama's come out against the Keystone oil pipeline. And you again say that this is in U.S. imperial interest. Explain that, my friend.
Yeah. So what's going on here? There's a lot of different factors involved with this decision. But I think we really have to look at sort of why are they doing it and what did Obama even say in doing this? That's part of the picture here, because he basically said that this pipeline, the Keystone XL pipeline, is not in the U.S. national interest, right? That's what he said. And he cited different factors in this decision. He said the pipeline would not make a meaningful long-term contribution to our economy. It would not lower gas prices. He said that this would not increase America's energy security. So these things are all pretty much straight up from the viewpoint of U.S. imperialism and its imperialist interests, its interests of empire, et cetera. But then he also said, well, and the other big factor here is that we've got this huge problem with climate change, and we have to address that. And he said we're going to have to keep some fossil fuels in the ground rather than burn them, because that's going to be carbon polluting, and we face this big problem with climate change. But I think it's really important to understand this is really coming from the position and couched in the position of the U.S. being seen in the world as leading on combating climate change. And he said that approving this pipeline would undercut this leadership. So they have a lot now staked in basically making it look like in the world that the U.S. is the world leader in combating climate change. And that's there's a lot of different factors, and why are they trying to do that? I mean, basically you have a situation where the U.S. for the past 20-some years has been the leading force in causing climate change and also in sabotaging international negotiations to do something about climate change. But the situation now is like some very powerful forces in the ruling class, including Obama, including forces in the U.S. military, et cetera, are saying, wow, the situation has changed. Basically, climate change has really thrust itself very violently in front of the entire world, right? You have study after study that are talking about not just the, kind of damage that's happening, but danger of huge disruptions in world civilization, mass migrations of hundreds and hundreds of millions of people, increasing warfare, increasing poverty. I heard a thing the other day that the World Bank said 100 million more people will be driven into poverty by climate change. So these forces in the ruling class are saying, wow, we've got to deal with this situation in some way, right, in some kind of meaningful way. But they're dealing with it, and they're only capable of dealing with it from the viewpoint of their own economic and political interests and their interests of empire.
All right, let me jump in here, because I want to remind listeners that you're tuned into the Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with Orpheus Reed, writer for Revolution Newspaper and RevCom.us, and we're talking about his most recent piece up there, Obama Rejects Keystone XL Pipeline, Why and What Does It Mean for the Endangered Planet? Now, Orpheus, when you're talking about these interests that the U.S. have, it's sort of, I really want to get clear. I want people to be clear on what these interests are, what's actually guiding their strategy right now. Because, yeah, it's like you mentioned the point about, you have the whole situation of the severity of the crisis, but you also make a point in the article and how that's impacting the rest of the world and how that's dealing in terms of the legitimacy of the system, of the U.S. capitalist system, the imperial system, and how it's able to operate in the world and the questioning of that legitimacy if it pushes ahead with all this, and that those are some of the things that various forces in the ruling class are taking into account here. But there's also, you say that even there, and this I think has something to do with what you were just saying, that what the U.S. is doing is actually looking at basically, well, two things. I mean, one, there is the reality that the U.S. has actually done quite a bit around the tar sands oils and all this other stuff that have gone on already. And, you know, they also, I mean, there's been all kinds of ways they've raped the planet in relation to all this. And now they're suddenly standing up and saying, well, it's you know, we're going too far. But you make the point that actually even there, what they're doing is they're more trying to manage a crisis and not deal with the crisis.
I mean, this is very, it shows a lot about where are they actually coming from, the kinds of things that they're doing, right? Are changes that are in line pretty much with what the U.S. economy, the direction it's already going. So they're transitioning from burning coal to burning natural gas, which is somewhat less carbon polluting and so forth. And so they're talking about making changes on the level of, I think it's 32% cuts in U.S. carbon emissions by 2030. And the deal is that we need much, much more massive cuts. That's the science of climate change, the actual level of the climate emergency says that cuts need to be made somewhere on the level of 60% per decade. That's what's really required. Basically, there needs to be, if we're really looking at the danger of climate change, we're looking at how severe it is, what is necessary to be done. We need to make immediate transitions, basically, to clean energy. We need to make immediate changes in the whole way the economy runs, in the whole way agriculture is done, so forth, in an approach to deforestation that just stops this in its tracks. Basically, we need radical transitions quickly. And that's not just, well, we would rather have radical transitions. We would, right? But the situation really demands that. So what they're doing is they're making these small, puny steps that are basically not too damaging for U.S. interests. And at the same time, they're also trying to use this crisis, and this is one of the really heavy things, I think. They're actually using this crisis, all of the various powers, but we're speaking mainly of the U.S. here. They're using this crisis as another form of rivalry, another form of competition. Whoever is seen as combating climate change in the world has more power in terms of what is going to be decided in these upcoming climate talks in Paris and kind of going forward from there. This is another indication, right? They're not coming from, look, we're facing an emergency. Let's do whatever is needed to stop this emergency for the planet and all its horrible effects that are going to happen to the world's people. We are going to, from the U.S., we're going to approach this from the interests of our position in the world and saving our power, saving our ability to be number one power dominating the planet, even in the face of these horrific changes that are already happening and are going to become much worse. And this is something that's very, very important to understand. It's not like a side issue of kind of like, well, he did the right thing, so therefore, you know, we don't really need to look too much deeper into it. Yes, we do, because there's a whole thing that this is part of here, and we have to understand that if we're going to be able to move from the interests of actually the people of the planet and saving the planet's environment itself.
Let me ask you this, Orpheus Reed. One of the things that I was thinking about off of reading your piece, you know, you talk about actually the unprecedented risk that's here. And I was thinking about the last time we spoke, and you were talking then about the, you know, emergence, the possible emergence of the next great extinction and all of this, and whether that's actually beginning already, and what that has to do with all this, you know, the oil and the use of oil and the drilling in the Arctic and just this, like, who the hell cares? Let's just get it out and the use of this for the military and everything else. And a lot of that necessity is still facing the U.S. in terms of the use of the need for oil. You know what I mean? The biggest consumer of oil in the world being the U.S. military. All of these kinds of things going on. And when you were talking about what the U.S. would have to do to counter the impact of all this, you also mentioned in your article describing the unprecedented risk, you referenced James Hansen, the climatologist James Hansen, making the point that developing tar sands oil reserves actually would be game over for the planet. This is pretty damn serious.
Right. It's very, very serious. And, I mean, the tar sands remains a huge, huge concentration. One of the largest concentrations of the world's oil remains in the tar sands, right? So this is not something. So, yes, I think what James Hansen was referring to, if you burned all of the oil in the tar sands, it would be absolutely game over for the planet. And there's been other studies that said to even keep the world's temperature from going above 2 degrees Celsius, which is considered, it's actually too high, but it's considered kind of like beyond that is catastrophe. To even do that, you cannot really exploit the tar sands oil. You can't exploit these unconventional sources of dirtier fossil fuels, such as tar sands and other sources like that, you have to stay away from that. So science has shown that. And the thing is that even though this decision has been made right now around Keystone XL, there's many other factors involved in this, including one of the big factors is that it's not especially profitable right now to continue to just all out extract and pipe tar sands oil because oil prices are so low. Oil is something like $50 a barrel now. So, I mean, all the experts are saying, okay, they're not rushing to build Keystone XL now, but it's not over in the tar sands, right? This still remains one of the world's largest investment projects in the world. All these huge investments are there. The U.S. and Canada both see this as a strategic source of energy that can be used as a weapon. They use this stuff as a weapon in all their rivalry with other powers and keeping, you know, Iran and Russia and so forth in line, trying to fight these battles out. The oil from the tar sands and also oil and natural gas in the U.S. itself are a key weapon of this. So they're not walking away from the tar sands. In fact, there's still a lot of pipeline proposals that are planned by various forces in the tar sands. It's something like a dozen pipeline proposals remain in the works. And TransCanada, who now is not building the Keystone pipeline, has already said they may bring another application for another pipeline to be built from the tar sands. So there's some factors right now limiting some of the production going on there, but in a long-term sense, in a strategic sense, they are far from moving away from the tar sands. And, you know, one of the points I make in the article that this is going to remain true as long as capitalism is ruling this earth. Fossil fuels are really foundational to their whole functioning, to their whole power in the world, to the military, as you pointed out. You know, the U.S. military is the largest institutional consumer of oil in the world. So these things are really foundational to the power of U.S. imperialism, all the imperialist powers, and it's not a question of, as Obama says, well, we just need this oil to transition until we get to clean energy. No, they're not giving up on any of this stuff, and they really can't, and that's why we need mass struggle to stop these things. But also we need a revolution. We need a whole different system than this to really be able to tackle this climate crisis in the way needed.
Mm-hmm. Now, Orpheus, one more question. What does all this have to do? I keep thinking about Paris coming up and these big talks that are happening in Paris. And, you know, one might be cynical or considered cynical if you sat back and said, well, he's just doing this to make a good show at Paris. What do you think that this has to do with what's going to happen in Paris?
Yeah, I think it has to do with maneuvering for who's going to be the decider, right? I mean, Obama over the last couple of years has invested a lot in the U.S. being seen as leading on climate change. As I pointed out, this is really a mirage because the U.S. has been the leading, you know, historically the leading producer of carbon dioxide and continues. Like under Obama, actually, they have vastly expanded U.S. oil and gas production. They have vastly expanded that, and they are now the largest producers of this. So, but what this is about is wanting to look like, you know, and wanting to use this as a chance to maneuver to enhance their position in the world in terms of this rivalry of being who's going to be in the strongest position to dictate the terms of how things are going to go around climate negotiations, but that also impacts and intersects with many other things in the world. So this is about really positioning to save U.S. empire in the face of these huge changes that are coming up in the world, to try to maintain the legitimacy of the system, right? I mean, people, millions and tens of millions of people recognize what a serious situation we face, what a crisis we're in, right? And there's the question of what are all those people going to do? Are they going to go against the system? Are they going to rise up against the system? Are they going to be a force fighting for a whole different kind of world? Or can they be kind of pulled in and, you know, pulled back into the framework of relying on the system and hoping against hope that the system is going to be able to solve this crisis, which it just is not capable of doing.
All right. Orpheus Reed, I want to thank you very much for joining us today.
Thanks a lot, man.
And I will remind people that if you want to see what Orpheus was talking about in terms of a society that could actually rationally deal with trying to cure all the stuff that's happened to the planet over these centuries, go to revcom.us and look for the document State of Emergency, The Plunder of Our Planet, The Environmental Catastrophe, and A Real Revolutionary Solution. All right, you're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we've just been talking with journalist Orpheus Reed. He's a writer for Revolution Newspaper and revcom.us, and we've been speaking about his latest piece, Obama Rejects Keystone XL Pipeline, Why? And what does it mean for the endangered planet? We're going to take a quick musical break, and when we come back, we will be talking with Lucha Bright and Joe Scogan, two of the defendants arrested on April 14th in a protest against police murder and brutality and now facing serious charges and on trial. So stay tuned. No sympathy. No sympathy. No sympathy.
Fit for rhyme, BS fit to spit. The hate reduced, thrown up in a noose. Most in history pages, comes in all stages, colors, genders, and ages.
Devil.
Black, brown, yellow, red, but white. Supremacy, tendency, and currency. Estrogen, robbing my oxygen. Still dissing skin, inform my next of kin.
Get in the back of the car. What? Let's go.
Crazy. Government created grown up 80s crack babies. Treat your ass cold to the frostbite bites.
PE, Public Enemy, with No Sympathy from the Devil. On November 5th, the trial began for three of the people who were arrested during Shutdown A14 protests to stop police murder. On April 14th, 2015, people took to the streets in more than 30 cities across the country to say that the movement to stop police murder was not going away and nobody should accept business as usual, in which police kill people every day and get away with it. This year to date, more than 1,000 people have been killed by the police. 15 demonstrators were arrested on April 14th in Los Angeles in an act of civil disobedience. And now the authorities are charging them with misdemeanors, which could bring at least a year in jail. And we're going to be talking with Lucha Bright, one of those arrested, and Joe Scogan, also one of those arrested. Lucha, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Michael.
All right, Joe, and welcome to the show.
Thanks.
Okay, well, let's jump into this. For people who don't know what happened on April 14th and why they should know, tell them what it was all about and what happened.
It was all over the country, people taking to the streets out of an understanding that the whole wave of protests that had gone on since Ferguson had opened up to the light of day the horror of police murder, and people were standing up to say this has to stop. And in the wake of that, there was repression, there was arrests, there was slander of the protests and protesters, much of which is continuing to go on now. But at that time, there was a recognition nationally that this movement had to get stronger and it had to come back against all of that in a way that the whole world had to see it. And that's what Shutdown A14 was. In New York City, they blocked the Brooklyn Bridge. In different parts of the country, people took to the streets very defiantly, very joyously, but with a lot of determination to say murder by police has to stop, and we are determined to put a stop to it.
Joe, what would you say about that?
Yeah, I'd say Lucha summed it up pretty good. There had been an uprising. A group of protesters had come out about police violence, and slowly we'd seen those uprisings get squashed down by the police. And so this was an attempt to rekindle that fire and spark it and make it even larger.
Having been there, I was also very impressed by the rally itself that drew out like quite a number of people, a large number of people at the rally, more so than even were on the march as it went through the city. But it really brought forward something that became much more developed in this past October in terms of the resistance of families. But the family members who spoke and all of these young people who were coming out into the street for the first time and who are faced with the situation where their lives don't mean anything to this system. And they're standing up and saying, not just for themselves, but for every young person, for every person of color, every person, that the police have no right to do this and we won't tolerate it. And that was something that really marked that day. I have to say, as people were marching through downtown, they marched into Skid Row, the reception that people got, it was very, very cool and important what happened then.
Yeah, there was four high schools that had high school walkouts that day and came out of school. And I remember being at the rally, and there was a lot of students that were already there, a lot of different kinds of people there. And then all of a sudden, you just see this roar coming down the street of at least 100, maybe 200 students from, I think it was from Maya Angelou High School. And it was just, it was beautiful. And they were very determined. And they talked about how the administration at their school threatened them and tried to stop them and all of these things. And they were determined that they were going to be there. And a big part of why they were determined is actually they had been down to Skid Row and seen the place where Charlie Africa was murdered. And it was a horrendous assassination by the police where they beat him down outside of his tent and then shot him on the ground in front of people and on camera. And there was no prosecutions in that. And a lot of people, really, it was not that long after that April 14th happened. And that was part of the fury that went into people coming out on that day.
Mm-hmm. Joe, what compelled you to be there, to be part of this?
To be brutally honest, I happened to be there at that time and I knew of the fact that it was going on. I'd gotten an email about the event, and I happened to be on City Lawn, and I was like, this is definitely a worthy cause. I don't see why I should go and do anything else on that day.
When you got to a certain point in the march, there was also a nonviolent civil disobedience action that took place. Tell people what that was and what happened.
Well, at the end of the march, after we marched through Skid Row and, you know, some of the sites where people had been killed by the police, at the end of it, we ended up at the Blue Line train tracks on Washington, and people stayed there on Broadway and Washington for a long time, for a couple of hours. We were there, and people were calling out the names of the people murdered by the police. We had a massive Stolen Lives banner with all of these faces of people killed all across the country. Tamir Rice, Michael Brown, Ayanna Stanley Jones, and the lives of those people lost were being brought out in everything we were doing. And at that point, people decided, we're shutting this city down. We're staying here on, you know, this these train tracks on Washington. And the Blue Line train got shut down for at least an hour. I think it may have been 2 hours. And the police came in and arrested people.
Now, Joe, saying that this was, you really thought that this was an important thing to do, that's one thing to join the march. It's also another thing to get busted in an action like that. Tell us about that.
Well, sometimes you just have to stop the system. Sometimes it seems that the tools that they use to suppress these movements are to tell people, well, we feel for you. We understand that, you know, you have some problems with the police brutality that's going on, but you need to keep on moving about, going about your business. Therefore, you don't have the time to talk about it or to reflect about it. And so people, unfortunately, just get pushed and pushed and pushed, and they never again get a chance to reflect about it or talk about it. And so I felt that by, as small as this was, it was stopping part of society in the way it's going and the day-to-day just mush along kind of business as usual. And so therefore, hopefully, people would be able to step back and go, no, let's stop and let's talk about this.
Let me remind listeners that you're tuned into the Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with Lucha Bright and Joe Scogan, who are two of the people that were arrested on April 14th in downtown L.A. for a nonviolent civil disobedience in opposition to police murder and brutality. What are the charges that people are actually facing? And, you know, I know that in stuff that I've read, you've said that they're a product of the political agenda of this system and not usual in the real sense of things.
Well, all 10 of us are facing 3 misdemeanor charges. The charges each carry a year possible jail sentence. And the charges are trespassing on the train tracks, for disobeying a police officer, and the last one is for, I think, blocking public access. I think what you said is exactly right. They have the discretion at any time to not prosecute people for acts of civil disobedience. And in fact, most of the time, they don't. But we're in a situation in this country where the genocidal terror and murder being carried out by the police is getting exposed in ways that it never has before, and where people are standing up and acting in all kinds of ways to say, we are not going to allow this. We are not going to accept a society that can murder a 12-year-old child like Tamir Rice. We're coming up on the anniversary of the murder of Tamir Rice. 12 years old, playing with a toy gun in a park. They can shoot him down within seconds. And then a year later, there's no justice. And they're coming out with these reports talking about how it was a reasonable shooting. And there are more and more people who are saying, we refuse to live in a society like this. We refuse to accept this. And I think for the powers that be, this is very dangerous. And they are going all out to try to put a stop to these protests and to punish people who are standing up and to send the message that this is not going to be tolerated. And we are trying to send a much larger message as well, that this is not going to stop. And in fact, we're going to grow and strengthen this movement to put a stop to this.
Let's talk about some of the things that happened, what you've been met with there.
Well, currently, Joe and I, our trials actually have not started yet because there are 10 of us and they split up the cases and they're trying them in groups. And so there's another trial that has started where three people are on trial. And Joe and I have been going to the courthouse to support them on all of their court dates. And from the very beginning, I was going for my own hearings as well as with the other people. And the first hearing, I was stopped for wearing a T-shirt that says BA Speaks, Revolution, Nothing Less. And they detained me and several other people for wearing that T-shirt. And they said that T-shirt was not allowed in the courthouse. They detained my lawyer, who was with me, and took a picture of the shirt to show the judge. And the lawyer had to go up. He had to go up and for a contempt hearing, which he was found not in contempt. And he showed the picture to the judge, and the judge basically had to issue an order saying that we were allowed into the courthouse with our T-shirts. And incidentally, and actually not so incidentally, while they were doing this, some of the people who were with us didn't even have the T-shirt on. They had a black T-shirt underneath another shirt, and they were also stopped. And the sheriff said, we stopped them because we thought their T-shirts might say Black Lives Matter. So when we finally were allowed back into the courthouse, they then singled me and one other person out to search our bags and pulled out flyers from our bags and said we couldn't take those into the courthouse and all of this. Ever since then, almost every time I've gone back into the courthouse, I've been singled out for a bag search. And the second time I went after this whole incident happened, as soon as they saw me, they took me out of the line, they searched my bag. I had a couple of flyers in my bag and they told me I was not allowed into the courthouse. I had a hearing that day, so I had to leave the courthouse. The attorney had to go up to the hearing. The judge of that hearing then had to order the sheriffs to allow me into the building to go to my own hearing. And two sheriffs escorted me up to the hearing. And basically ever since then, it's most of the times I go in there, they're stopping, searching my bag. So there's just an atmosphere of harassment, you know, of this all the way around.
You know, it sounds like some really distorted, and this is saying something, some really distorted Fellini film that you're going through in terms of this whole back and forth where, you know, just to get into trial, you have to actually go through all kinds of hell to, you know, just to get in there. Joe, I want to go back to something that you said. I was thinking as you were talking, because the point of the morality involved, one of the things that I thought that was really very heavy in relation to all of this, there's a question of morality. That's actually really bone deep in this, you know, that if you can stand, whether it impacts you or not directly, if you can stand and just watch this go by, you're in a whole hell of a lot of trouble. And humanity's in a whole hell of a lot of trouble if everyone is thinking like that. There's a real need for people like yourself, Joe, to stand up. As you said, this was a chance for you to do something that really mattered. And I wanted to explore that a little bit more in relation to now you're facing these charges and you're facing the possibility of, what was it, 3 years in jail?
Mm-hmm.
What is it that, you know, when you think about the point of the moral compass that was involved and the idea that which side are you on? And you clearly spoke about choosing your side. So could you talk a little bit more about that?
I don't want to have to serve some sentence for this, but I look at it as maybe it'll help spread some light as far as the issues. Lucha talked earlier about the district attorney can choose to prosecute whoever she wants to. How come she's not prosecuting any police and she's prosecuting the people who are speaking out against the police? So at least something good will come out of it. No, I don't want to go. I don't want to serve 1 minute in prison. Prison is meant to be a torture system. You know, it's another tool for the system to oppress the people. But if I have to, hopefully some good will come out of it. People will realize how f***ed up the system is.
That's important. I mean, it's really important because that point about the moral compass, that point about the stand that needs to be taken, that needs to be spread, you know, and you look at something like recently around Rise Up October where Quentin Tarantino came out and he made a very simple statement. As a human being with a conscience, when I see somebody who's been murdered, I have to say, that's the murdered. And I have to call the murderer the murderer. And when he said that, and speaking at the main rally at the Rise Up October event in New York, And you think about the way that everything jumped on him. And in a sense, it's similar to, you know, it's in a different way, and it's bigger because of who he is and the, you know, his sort of footprint in society. But it's also very important in terms of what you guys did, because you laid down in front of this, down or whatever, and you said, we're not going to move. We're taking a stand and saying, no, damn it, you're not going to get away with this. We are going to shine a light on you, and we're going to be calling more and more people out to do this. And I think that's extremely important. So what you were talking about, I think, is really important. The courage of your convictions, of your moral conviction, and the need to stand up and fight against this is extremely important. Lucha, I want to ask you, Rise Up October. This was a huge, it had a huge footprint itself on the society. It was, you know, thousands of people in New York on that day of the march, and people, and, you know, I can't remember how many families it was, and the aim was for 100 families. I can't remember whether we got 100 families or not, but it was a significant, a sizable number of families who spoke, who led the march, and who marked the day with tears of rage and a voice that just, like, the strength of their voices, really angry and committed to resistance around this. How you see the impact of that and the relationship between that and what you guys are going through with this trial?
Well, I think what happened there with the, you know, as you described it, the thousands who were there and the impact of the families, and there was 3 days of it too. And the 24th, it was this massive march throughout Manhattan, and the one that Quentin Tarantino was at and other people. And I think when you look at what happened with that, they did put, and we did put all over the country, the question, which side are you on in front of the society? Which side are you on in supporting and going along with or being silent in the face of murder by police, or standing up and saying we refuse to live in a society that carries this out, where the police can murder unarmed people day after day after day, disproportionately Black, Latino, Native American people, and every time they're getting away with it, every time that's being justified by the workings of the system. And Rise Up October was really taking to a whole other level the movement and fight to put a stop to this. And it got covered all over the world. And I think this all has to do with going forward on a whole other level to actually bring things to the point where the society can't continue in the same way that it has been, where the police are allowed to carry out this terror.
What can people do?
On the 23rd of this month, in a week about, is the anniversary of the murder of Tamir Rice, and there's going to be protests all over the country, the 22nd and the 23rd, demanding that the police who killed Tamir Rice be indicted, convicted, and put in jail, and that people standing up to stop police murder, that the charges be dropped against freedom fighters.
Lucha Bright, thank you very much.
Can I say one other thing people can do?
Yes, go ahead.
The city attorney is who's prosecuting this. Her name is Jennifer Waxler. She's a deputy city attorney. And people can call in to the city attorney's office and demand the charges be dropped.
Okay, Joe Scogan, thank you very much for joining us today. We're going to take a quick musical break. And when we come back, we'll be talking with the director and actors from a brand new play. And the play is called Painted Rocks at Revolver Creek. So stay tuned. All right, it's almost impossible to break into that, okay? But that's Africa is the Mirror of All Colors by Ornette Coleman. All right, see, Teddy's jumping up and down. Now, I knew that. I was going to guess that. I was going to say that. Anyway, I'm really happy that we've gotten to this stage of the show, to this part of the show, and have some time to just, like, wallow around in it, because I saw a play last weekend that was just incredible, just blew my mind, all right? And it's Athol Fugard's latest play. And the play, I mean, I'm telling you, it's incredible. The play is The Painted Rocks at Revolver Creek. I have so much to talk about in relation to this. And I'm going to do something I don't normally do, which is I normally ask people to talk about what the play was, you know, but I'm just going to do this so we can get this out of the way and jump into bigger things. The play is basically about a man named Nukain. And it's played by one of my guests, Thomas Silcott. Thomas, welcome to the show.
Good morning. And the play is also directed by Simon Levy, who's sitting over there. I don't know what he's doing over there. Simon, hi. Welcome to the show.
I'm posting you on Facebook.
Oh, good. Great. Just what I need. There you go.
This is how it works in the digital age, Michael.
I told you. I'm not there. Anyway, it tells the story of Nukain, this artist. Actually, it's really revealing about the content of the play and the fact that you hardly ever hear his name in the first act, which is extremely, it just blew me away anyway. But he spent his life transforming the rocks at Revolver Creek into a vibrant garden of painted flowers. And faced with the presence of the final unpainted rock and at the insistence of his young companion, Boki, who, by the way, is an incredible actor, this young kid, man, Philip Solomon, he's really, really good. He's forced to confront his legacy as an artist and as a black man in 1981 South Africa, and which is, if you remember, I was telling Simon that when we were at the play, I'd spent some time in South Africa right as the state of emergency was being declared and then went back another time and spent a good deal of time there and really traveling around the country and talking with people who had been the revolutionaries who had been involved in fighting against apartheid and bringing their stories back. But this tells a story that's actually related to that, but very different. It talks about the lives of black people in South Africa. It also talks about the life of the Boers in South Africa. And sitting across from me also is Sue-Ann Spoke.
Hi.
Hi. How are you?
I'm good.
Good. Well, I'm just glad you're from Pittsburgh, okay? And your character is someone who has been, basically who has this land, who enjoys all the benefits of apartheid, who enjoys really of apartheid society, including the total denial of the humanity of the African people, which serves her well and serves all of the Boers well. So having said that, I'm going to jump into a few questions. Fugard said that this play, the stories that need to be told today are even more urgent than the stories that needed to be told under apartheid. Why don't we start, Simon, with you, and then we'll just go around and see what people think. What do you think of that? Why do you think he's saying that?
Well, I think that Athol, he's portrayed the life in South Africa, for, four decades now, five decades. And I think he's very afraid of what's going on in South Africa, unless there's going to be reconciliation, true reconciliation between blacks and whites there, then I think that he feels that the country is on the verge of some kind of a collapse. So he feels the need to chronicle that in the same way that he chronicled life under apartheid.
Mm-hmm. Thomas, what do you think?
Through this whole process of putting up the show, it's just, I see how it mirrors everything that's going on today in today's society. And it's definitely a show that needs to be, has a lot to be said about not being seen, about not coming to an understanding of somebody who's different than you and appreciating them. And it's sad that even after all this time, it's still going on. Sue-Ann posted an article on Facebook not too long ago about how a lot of this is still going on, where students are protesting about what they're being taught in university and how tuition is going up and how they're being pushed out of the university because they can't afford to learn. They can't afford to become professionals at something that is much greater than something that's menial. And they're protesting against that, and the government is rising up against that. And it's all very mirrored to what has been already going on in South Africa years ago.
Apparently the educational system is collapsing as well.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Well, it's certainly being corrupted.
Yeah.
The addition of these tuitions that students are being saddled with, like in their last semester, that will prohibit them from graduating.
Mm-hmm. I'm going to assert my privilege here because I think it's good to talk about the question of the links between what's happening here now and what's happening in South Africa. But I also think there's a bigger link in relation to this. And Sue-Ann, I think that actually has something to do with the character you play and the character you play in both forms, where, and I have to say, Thomas plays the character who is old and who has lived his life as a non-being, and almost even to himself, even though there's that spark that he put out there to actually paint those rocks, which was more than decorating a bone dry and pile of dirt and dust. And he actually was creating a world where he was somebody. And it was a big struggle for him to get into that. And we'll talk about that in a minute. But Sue-Ann, your character also asserts that I am somebody. Actually, I am everybody. And I'm all that matters in a certain sense, which I'll tell you, having been in South Africa, that's a Boer view. That really is. And I've read a couple of comments about the play where they say that, you know, well, you know, the assertion that, you know, she's right, your character is right in the second act when she starts talking about, oh, good, now that the blacks are, you know, free of all this, it's going to be nothing but trouble and farmers are getting, white farmers are getting executed and you're just, you people are just going to ruin everything. Let's talk about that because you bring that character to life and I think that's a very hard thing to do.
Thank you. I appreciate that very much. So much of what she is in some ways is very antithetical to who I am as a human being and what I sort of ascribe as a belief system and how I like to behave in the world, just so everybody out there knows that before they see the play.
You mean you're not your character?
But I had to find a way to substantiate her self-righteousness, and some of that has to do with experience, background, acclimating oneself to what is around you and subscribing to that sort of belief. And the way in for me that was very powerful was the fact that I actually grew up on a farm. And so I could make that point of reference very strongly in terms of what I believe about the land and the earth and the people that work it and till it and who works for them and how you provide for them to the best of your ability and not mixing, and because that was something that I grew up with. Also, the research that we did to see what actually happened, we saw several number of photographs of the corpses of the farmers, what had transpired, which fueled me in another way. But the nature of the writing, I think, is such that I'm given an enormous amount of liberty to go as far as I can in terms of actualizing her, because there is a moment of revelation and her learning something that she did not know before, which I think redeems her.
Well, yeah, and although we'll dig into this, because there is a point to, and well, first let me remind listeners that you tuned into The Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with Simon Levy, the director, and two of the actors, Thomas Silcott and Sue Ann Spoke, from the play The Painted Rocks at Revolver Creek. But, you know, Sue Ann, one of the things that I was thinking as you were saying this, because there's truth, you know, and I kept thinking when I saw this in the play, who knows what Fugard's thinking, because he was a very special white person in South Africa. He really was. There were some people, there was white resistors when I was there. There was the anti-military movement. There were people who, I'll never forget a story about a white guy who joined the Black Consciousness Movement, and they were being tried in Cape Town. And as the judge went through and asked everybody to go through the procedure of identifying themselves and their race, everybody said, I am so-and-so, and they would just... The judge would say, you're so-and-so, and you are Xhosa. And he'd say, and they'd shout, I am so-and-so, and I am black. And it got to this guy sitting down at the last seat. And the judge goes, you are so-and-so, and you are white. And the guy said, I am so-and-so, and I am black. And the whole courtroom went in an uproar, and they all went back, and they had to decide this. But, you know, what was real, what was true, what wasn't. And they decided that it was true because this man actually was standing with the African people. Mm. You know, he had rejected his privilege. He was living in townships. But he also knew that he enjoyed a certain privilege. And so when you talk about that, being shown the pictures of the dead farmers, I think one thing that has to go along with that, I really believe firmly that you can't run any kind of society that would be any good for humans where revenge is what is the engine driving things, even for a little bit. You're just going to screw things up completely and make it even worse. But there is also, you know, I want people to see not only what happened to the black people in South Africa before apartheid ended, but what continues to happen today. Mm-hmm. Because it is not good for black people. And for, you know, this sympathy for the Boers, it's like sympathy for the devil, right? Because there's an element, and I think, again, what you bring to that character in the staunchness of the belief, even though there's a few chips here and there, but in the end, you got the gun, which a number of reviewers have said you've made the cross as dangerous as the gun, and they're pretty much equivalent in a certain sense. But I think we need to actually look at this because, Simon, I was thinking something you said. You said that in the heart of the play is the need to be seen and the need to be recognized.
As an individual.
Yes, yes, yes. As an individual, and then I would add for myself, and as a people, because that was the humanity of an entire people was denied. You
know? And we talked a lot about that during the rehearsal process, about how they were representative of their race, of being black in South Africa, in the case of Tom and Gilbert, and in the case of Sue Ann, of being Afrikaner, that they are representative of those people and the representative of those belief systems. But the miracle of Athol and why he is one of our greatest living playwrights is because he is able to anchor that in the humanity of individuals, in the specificity of these individuals. And so these are characters that we kind of fall in love with, in certainly in the case of Tom and Philip and Gilbert, and in a sense in with, you know, the character that Sue Ann plays as well, because she has that wonderful, beautiful line where she says, you know, "I'm just a frightened white woman." And what is that like?
And again, like I said, I think there is the necessity to actually have this understanding and this relationship between people. But I would say, again, in like a lot of ways, you know, you could never tell the plantation owners who were really upset that their humanity was not being recognized when slavery ended. I really don't give a damn about them in a certain sense. And that's what you had in South Africa. And so, but the thing is I also said, like I said, you can't build a society based on revenge. You have to have certain things that are set in place in order to deal with the inequality and the non-existence, the not being seen that so many African people lived under.
Well, and I think, you know, at the end of the play, I think that that's what Athol is trying to demonstrate, right. That these people can now see each other. And, you know, we talked about how the first half of that second act, we wanted them talking at each other because that's what we do, right? Mm-hmm. But then in the second half, now they start talking to each other. And maybe that's where the miracle lies ultimately,
and that,
you know,
that,
where people can really talk to each other.
And that's huge. That's a huge moment when Gilbert stops and he says, no, let's look, we're talking. We may be arguing at each other, but let's try again. Yeah. We're talking. We got something going here.
Now, just so people who understand, Gilbert is the other actor who plays the young boy at the beginning of the play, who's actually really Tom. He's sort of like your hope for the future.
He's my hope for my future, exactly.
And then Gilbert plays him grown up, who confronts you, Sue Ann, as he's going back to, again, not only establish the humanity of your character, Thomas, who's since, you know, died and been buried in an unmarked grave somewhere.
Right.
But he's also demanding the and it's interesting the way it's put, because I think Fugard really does wrestle with these things very strenuously. When he said, look, I'm looking at this as sort of, he says, yes, and I recognize that you have a right to exist, talking to you, Sue Ann. Mm-hmm. And he says, you have a right to this stuff, but you know what? You're right. He essentially says, your right doesn't override my right, my humanity, and
the
things that need to be done in order to, you know, basically reconcile this actually has to be the recognition of, look, South Africa is, it's an African country. The Boers came there a long time ago, but it's an African country. And so if Boers want to live there, they need to do so, recognizing that it's an African country. Mm-hmm. And the African people have to have that largeness of mind to say, okay, we're not going to allow some things, but we are going to open our arms to people who want to cooperate with us, you know, and who want to live together as humans. And Tom, I want to ask you, because your character, really one of the most intense characters in the play. I mean, I think you have, Sue Ann, you have a very intense character, but your character, who so much is bottled up inside of him, in that whole first act, it's just so much is like just bursting to get out, and you're confronted with the declaration of you need to make this declaration of your humanity, and you're not even sure you can do it, and you're scared of it, and you're also, you know, you're eager to have it out there, and you're so celebratory, but then Sue Ann, your character, comes on and says, wash that wall, will you?
Yeah.
So let's talk about that, because that's a very, I mean, that was so heavy, you know?
I think that...
You got to say it in 1 minute or 30 seconds.
You got to say it in 1 minute or 30 seconds.
Yeah, I was looking at the wrong clock. So.
Wow.
In the real Nukain's life, he had 15 years to work on this side of this kopje, this hill with all these rocks before he got to that large rock. And I think that he's faced with, how am I going to make this final expression of who I am? And so the weight of that is the thing that he battles against. And he comes from an old school where he doesn't have the voice to be able to say that. But in the copy, he does. And he gets it out there until...
You got it.
Okay, good.
All right, that brings us to the end of yet another show. But before we go, there's something very serious I want to talk with you about. And that's the recent terrorist attacks in Paris and what's happened in the aftermath of that. On November 13th, simultaneous attacks across Paris took the lives of at least 129 people. ISIS, the reactionary armed Islamist movement now dominating parts of Syria and Iraq, has apparently taken credit for these attacks. The victims were normal, everyday people. They were eating in cafes, attending a soccer game, or walking down the street.
They were people of all walks of life, from France and around the world. The gruesome and arbitrary nature of the killing, including the massacre of 89 people trapped in a concert hall where a rock band was playing, could only be intended to create an atmosphere of societal chaos and fear. And the attack was clearly undertaken with knowledge that it would be invoked by France and the U.S. to supposedly justify new rounds of repression and war. The cruel horror of the Paris attacks should be unequivocally denounced. At the same time, the French president declared that this is an act of war, and he would hit back with a merciless response. We should be clear. This threat from France and the ways in which this attack has taken over the airwaves and the political life in the U.S. since it was carried out are very ominous. This almost certainly means one thing: more war and military attacks in the Middle East coming from France, the other European powers, and the U.S. itself, taking even more lives and creating all that many more refugees to add to the literally millions now desperately seeking to survive, who often lose their lives in the process. And so the nightmarish dynamic which billions of people today find themselves locked in intensifies and escalates. The world cries out for another way. To get that other way, we have to understand, first of all, the root causes of the dynamic that is going on. All right, I'm going to stop reading here, but I really want to encourage people to go to revcom.us. That's right, the site revcom.us, and check out this really powerful article on the Paris attacks. The article is titled A Terrorist Attack in Paris, A World of Horrors, and the Need for Another Way. Check the article out, read it, spread it, share it, get it all over the place. Extremely important, all right? And in talking about bringing forward that other way, I thought it would be really important to revisit something from Bob Avakian, the chairman of the Revolutionary Communist Party, and his book, Basics. Check this out. What we see in contention here with jihad on the one hand and McWorld, McCrusade on the other hand are historically outmoded strata among colonized and oppressed humanity up against historically outmoded ruling strata of the imperialist system. These two reactionary poles reinforce each other, even while opposing each other. If you side with either of these outmodeds, you end up strengthening both. While this is a very important formulation and is crucial to understanding much of the dynamics driving things in the world in this period, at the same time, we do have to be clear about which of these historically outmodeds has done the greater damage and poses the greater threat to humanity. It is the historically outmoded ruling strata of the imperialist system, and in particular, the U.S. imperialists. That's from Bob Avakian, the chairman of the Revolutionary Communist Party. It's from his book, Basics. It's the first chapter, the 28th entry in the first chapter. So check that out. All right, that does bring us to the end of yet another show. And what I want to do now is I want to thank all of my guests today. I want to thank my assistant producer, Henry Carson. I want to thank my production assistant, Jeff Pryor, my board offer today, Teddy Robinson, and each and every one of you for tuning in. If you want to write to me, you can at mslate@themichaelslateshow.com. Once again, that's mslate@themichaelslateshow.com. Write, and I'll read it, and I'll think about it, chew on it, and maybe even get back to you, all right? So that's about the size of it. Right now, we're going to go out with a song that I think really captures a lot of what today's show is about, Down Presser Man from Peter Tosh. Talk to you again next week.
Man, where you gonna run to? Down, presser man, where you gonna run to?